Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll welcoming you to a special series of banter podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. We began our Portuguese debut with Bradley Tusk. It's the morning after Donald Trump's shock victory in the US presidential election and the political consultant who worked on Michael Bloomberg's successful run for New York mayor amongst many other campaigns is telling us what went wrong or right, depending on how you look at it. Bradley also has much to say about his client Uber and his bete noir, current New York mayor Bill de Blasio. Please excuse the background noise. The Banter stage at Web Summit was located in the main hall and there was a lot of coming and going behind us.
None of you have ever been at Banter before, bar the bearded gentleman at the back. Banter is basically headquartered in Dublin, Ireland, and it's a series of long-form conversations, talks, and discussions. They're basically very informal, very casual, very laid-back. In the tech world, you call them fireside chats. So for our first fireside chat at Web Summit, we're pleased, really, really pleased to welcome Bradley Tusk to Long. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me. Everybody, thank you for listening to me. I'm not sure why you are, but thank you.
How's your Web Summit been so far?
It's been good. I kind of combined it with a vacation. So my wife and I came Friday night, hung out in Lisbon for a couple of days. I did a couple of panels at another venue on Monday, and then, you know, had quite a night last night. I haven't slept in about 32 hours at this point, something like that.
Okay.
And then here we are.
Okay, so let's talk about last night, and let's start there before we kind of head to Illinois and your role as a deputy governor there back in the day.
Sure.
What did you make of last night? I mean, give people as well a sense of where you're coming from, because you
sure.
were Michael Bloomberg's campaign manager.
Yeah, so couple of things. So my background is in, right now, the reason I guess I'm here is I'm a venture capitalist. I've got a fund we work with specifically to invest in pre-IPO startups in regulated industry. Started doing Uber about 5.5 years ago and have about 20 companies in our portfolio right now. But prior to that, my career was in government politics. So I ran my Bloomberg's mayoral campaign in 2009, worked for him in City Hall in his first term. I was the deputy governor of Illinois for 4 years, worked on Capitol Hill for Chuck Schumer. So my background's really in government and politics, even though now it's applied more in technology. So that's my perspective. You know, look, I tried to get some of these points out on the main stage earlier, if you guys happen to see that. And, you know, it was a competitive panel to get a word out, so, and I probably wasn't aggressive enough. So, in my view, right or wrong, I think there are five things that probably help explain last night. Can I get into all five? Is that okay?
You can. This is relaxed. You
Great.
Take as long as you want.
So the first is sort of this, like, yeah, no shit. People are pissed off. We saw Trump, you know, win the primaries because of that. We saw Brexit happen a couple of months ago. There is a large number of people who feel really disaffected. And if you take a step back and think about it, you could look at the world as a whole, the 7.5 billion people, and say there is a higher global standard of living than ever. There are fewer people living in extreme poverty than ever. There are fewer people with extreme disease than ever. There are fewer people living under, you know, military reign than ever. But when you take a pie and expand it from country of 300 million people, country of, what's the UK, 80, 90, whatever, million people.
Yeah, UK, 56 million.
56 million people to 7.5 billion people, it spreads out, right? And as a result, the guy in Indiana who felt secure that he'd always have this kind of middle-class job has seen that job go to India. Now, is it inherently worse that 8 people in India now have the ability to feed their family at the expense of 1 person in Indiana? You know, I may not think so, you may not think so, but that guy in Indiana sure thinks so, right? And there's enough of that guy in Indiana, that guy in Brighton in the UK or whatever it is, that led to a lot more people voting for Trump than expected. So that's number one. Number two is sort of, how did the media miss this, right? And I think it's not only did the media miss it, I think in a perverse way, the media might have helped actually produce the outcome last night, right?
So when you say media, let's be sure. You mean mainstream media.
I mean mainstream, and look, I live in Manhattan, so I'm a New York City Jewish, like, I'm as much of that as it gets. But with that said, mainstream elite, liberal, New York City run media. That's really what I mean. So you've got that echo chamber combined with the Wall Street echo chamber, the Silicon Valley echo chamber, Hollywood echo chamber, and what is it? It's New York, San Francisco, LA, and a handful of other cities. And that's really it, right? Austin for South by Southwest, and a few other things like that. And they all talk to each other, and they all decide that they know what's best for everyone else. And I think they not only keep reinforcing each other's misconceptions, but they're so patronizing in how they go about it. Let me take a look. We're so patronizing in how we go about it that it probably alienated people even more and it probably drove them into Trump's camp. So that's number two. Number three is Hillary was a historically flawed candidate, and I would say for two particular reasons that both really run contrary to what the United States is about. So we broke away from England, you know, in 1776, because fundamentally our view was we want to pick who's in charge, and it shouldn't be by birthright or birth order. It should be by our selection. So whenever there's a candidate in the U.S. for office, and their main argument is effectively, it's my turn, the voters reject it. So if you look back, Al Gore, it was his turn. He didn't become president. John Kerry, John McCain, Bob Dole. I mean, look back at the last five, six presidential elections. There's almost always a my turn candidate, and they almost always lose because it's almost inherently un-American. And Hillary didn't really have an argument much better than, it's my turn. And then the second problem is when you play by your own set of rules for a period of 20, 30 years, and you benefit from the system in a way that is at the expense of everyone else, lo and behold, it pisses people off, right? I mean, one of the reasons that Bernie Sanders, who is a guy that, by the way, didn't achieve very much in Congress for a long time. It's not, he's not this exceptional human being. But the reason why he had so much traction against her is he just said, look, I have beliefs, and I'm not corrupt. And a huge swath of the Democratic primary electorate said, yeah. So the fact that then a lot of people either stayed home or, you know, voted for Gary Johnson, or maybe even some of them voted for Trump. Clearly, statistically speaking, some of them did vote for Trump. In retrospect, it's not that surprising. And then the fifth reason is there's some measure of sexism in there too, right? I don't think Hillary necessarily lost because she was a woman, but we have never had a female president. We had someone that by, you know, all accounts was poised to be the first female president. She loses kind of by surprise out of nowhere. To say that it was the determinant factor is probably not true, but to say that it had no impact would probably also not be true.
Right. Okay. So, you just kind of broken down their reasoning. So, I'm kind of thinking as you're talking there that that's the kind of logic that would have been discussed when Mike Bloomberg was thinking about running as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, you know, I think it's been well reported. We spent a couple of months this year looking at a race for Mike, looking at a third-party candidate. Mike ultimately chose not to run, ironically, because he was afraid that running would actually make it more likely that Trump would win, because our view is that if we ran, and I apologize if you already know this, but in the U.S., you need 270 electoral college, actually, last time everybody knows it, electoral college votes to win. If no one gets a 270, it goes to the House of Representatives, which is run by the Republicans. Mike's concern was he would win enough states to send it to the House, not enough to win outright, and the Republicans in the House would vote for the Republican candidate, and he would inadvertently make Trump president. In other words, if he didn't run, the assumption that we all made incorrectly was that Hillary would win. So he made the decision for the right reasons. It may or may not have been the right decision. It was well-intentioned. And you know, it's funny. I was talking to some of my Bloomberg colleagues this morning, and I said, like, did we screw up? Should he have run? Both because A, could he have won, and B, could we have actually prevented this outcome? And kind of Howard Wolfson, who I would argue is one of the smartest political strategists in the world, and Howard's point to me was it was an anti-elite election. Mike Bloomberg is the 10th richest man in the world. He's a short, divorced billionaire Jew from New York City. Like, he is not the candidate that's going to appeal to an anti-elitist voter. So, no, we should not have run.
I want to go back to your own career, but like I want to take up on something you just said there, Bradley, about like this being an anti-elite election in many ways. To an awful lot of people looking in, Donald Trump represents that elite. This is someone who's supposedly rich, who's got all the accoutrements and trappings of being a wealthy elite member, and yet, as you kind of say, this was an anti-elite election.
Yeah, it's interesting. So a few things about Trump. One is, look, he, as much as we all might like to hate him, he clearly has tremendous political retail skills and instincts, right? And, you know, there's being elite may mean your circumstances, your wealth, your education, everything like that, but it also just means your ability to relate. Hillary Clinton has almost no ability to relate to normal people, and therefore she's perceived as elite, whereas her husband, who went to the exact same schools as she did, has an incredible ability to relate to people, and therefore is perceived as the opposite. George W. Bush, not perceived as elitist at all, right? Perceived as anti-elitist. He went to Harvard, he went to Andover, he went to Yale, he's a Bush. I mean, you can't really be any more elitist than that, but I think he does have this very impressive ability to interact with pretty much anyone in a very regular way. And Trump, in a different way, I think, has that same ability. And that really transcends the fact that he lives, you know, in this three-story marble tower within Trump Tower.
I'd be curious to see what he'll make of the White House when he moves in. Will he bring the painters and decorators in to add gilt-edged touches?
Well, yeah, I think right now, because there are those columns, they're putting the T-R-U-M-P in giant gold letters on each of them as we speak. You got to imagine he's at least wondering, hey, can I get away with that? You know.
So which came first for you then, Bradley? Was it Lehman Brothers or was it the state of Illinois?
State of Illinois. So can I tell you a quick story of how I got started in politics?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a first-generation American and didn't grow up really with any connection or anything like that. But in the summer of 1992, shows you how old I am, the Democratic Convention, which in New York City, in fact, it was Bill Clinton, it was a nominating convention. And my dad had a friend who was a lawyer for the Carpenters Union. And this guy, Brian O'Dwyer, said to me, hey, look, if I can get you a carpenter's pass, you do I like politics, someone asks you to fix something, just pretend or run away or whatever it is. I said, okay, great. So if you look in the newspaper, it says that the convention is from noon to midnight. Anyone who's ever been to a convention knows it's basically from 8 p.m. to 10:30 or 11, and that's it. But I'm an 18-year-old kid. I don't know better. So I get there at noon. It's like two guys running for state rep in Montana speaking, and the whole garden is empty. There's a guy at the time named Ed Rendell, who at the time was the mayor of Philadelphia. He's since became the governor of Pennsylvania, did some other jobs in government politics. And he was sitting in the audience by himself. And I figured, okay, you know what? I just finished my freshman year at Penn, which is in Philadelphia. I go to school in Philly. He's the mayor of Philly. I'll say hello. Worst would happen, he'll come in and get lost. And you know, Rendell is the kind of guy that if he's not talking to you, he's talking to the empty chair. He's talking. There may be a human being there. There may not. So he was perfectly happy to have me to chat with. Chat for 10, 15 minutes, and I kind of realized, okay, my time's up. Thanks, Mr. Mayor. Really appreciate it. He said, hey, when you get back to school, are you busy? And I said, no, not particularly. He said, do you want an internship? I said, that'd be great. He said, okay, send me a note. We'll set it up. So I go home. I write a letter. And then every day I go, you know, I open the mailbox. There's no reply. And what I didn't know then, but I know now, is correspondence is the black hole of government. So everything comes in. Nothing goes out. So I get back to school. And, you know, it's like a decade before 9/11, so security is not what it is today. And I kind of think, I'll go see him. And I show up at City Hall, and I get to not his secretary, but kind of his outer office, and say, is the mayor here? And in retrospect, it's a crazy question to ask, right? You can't just go see the mayor. But I was sort of so young and naive that I didn't even occur to me that you couldn't do that. And the secretary, this nice old Italian lady from South Philly, and said, well, he's a little busy. And I said, oh, can I leave a note? She said, okay. So I write a note. I get back on the subway, go back to the dorm, and he's like, you schmuck, you can't do that. So I figure, okay, that's never going to happen. I get to the door, the phone rings, please hold for the mayor. When are you coming to work? So that's how I got started in politics. I worked for him all through college. And then after college, went to the New York City Parks Department, where I was the press secretary. Went to law school, realized I didn't want to be a lawyer. Went back to Parks for a while. Went to Capitol Hill, worked for Chuck Schumer as his communications director. Then Mike wins. I go to City Hall. And then I'm sitting in the bullpen at City Hall, a famous bullpen that Mike works out of, and the phone rings, and the guy on the other end says, do you want to be deputy governor of Illinois?
Okay, let's pause there. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, when I saw that bit in your bio, I was thinking, surely if you become deputy governor of Illinois, you got to stand before the electorate.
No, so it's an appointed position, and look, if the governor dies, you don't become governor, you become unemployed. A guy who you've all heard of for the wrong reasons, named Rod Blagojevich, had just become governor. In fact, it was funny. A guy who I worked with in the governor's office said to me last night, I don't know, 3 or 4 in the morning, he's like, this is like if they just made Rod president, you know? and which I thought was pretty apt. In fact, for Blagojevich, it was probably a great week. He's a rabid Cubs fan. I'm sure he liked Trump, and, you know, he's still got 10 more years to serve in jail, but at least he had two pieces of good news. Anyway, so what's a deputy governor? Why are you calling me? It's a guy that runs the state. And, you know, again, one of those sort of kind of crazy things, but they knew that he was literally crazy. They needed someone who was young enough, and I was 29 at the time, that it was such a career-making job that you would work literally 80, 90 hours a week, every week for 4 years, and you would put up with it because it was such a great opportunity. I think on one hand, and I knew a little bit of a lot of stuff. I knew about press. I knew about policy. I was a lawyer. I knew about operations. Like, I didn't know a lot about anything, but I knew a little bit about everything. So the benign view would be that was what they needed. The less benign view is they wanted someone young and naive so they could rob the place blind and nobody would notice. I think in retrospect, both were probably true.
Okay.
But what's interesting about Blagojevich is, and in some ways, this is not an irrational view. The job of running for office and the job of holding office, in many ways, are two totally different skill sets. And he saw his job as winning office. And he literally felt like, okay, I did my job. I won. I'll see you in 4 years. We'll do it again. So he wouldn't come to the office for 3-4 months at a clip. And so I remember the first year, you know, the legislature passed about 500 bills every session. I said, hey, you want to sign or veto these bills? Oh, we'll come and talk about it tomorrow. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But there's deadlines. I said, Rod, we got to work. You just figure it out. So I just started signing and vetoing the bills. And then I said, well, you know, we got a $65 billion budget. What do you want to put in it? We'll talk about it tomorrow. You just figure it out. I'm doing the budget. I'm doing the state of the state. I'm pardoning people. I'm denying pardons. You know, this whole fucking thing. And, like, running the state. And
How do you decide you're going to pardon someone?
So, you know what I saw? It's funny. Of all the things I did, that was the thing that I actually had the most discomfort with. So what I did is I only granted pardons if they were cleared by DNA evidence. And then I said anyone who is a violent offender and is applying for a pardon within, say, 7 years of their crime, automatically denied. And I didn't really solve the problem, but I took a backlog of, let's say, 10,000 pending pardons, and by kind of whacking out the people who were violent offenders and giving people who cleared by DNA evidence, obviously, their freedom back, kind of took the pressure valve off of the situation. And so did that for 4 years. And I think your original question that came in is incredibly long with the answer to was Lehman Brothers or Illinois. So
before we leave Illinois, like, it's curious, as you're talking way there about how Rob acted as kind of governor, you know, I'm reminded of a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago when they were imagining what a Trump White House would be like, and he was outsourcing everything. It sounds to me like Trump's going to hire in loads of Bradleys and kind of like let them do all dirty work.
You were joking last night that he could give Rod a pardon and put him in the cabinet. So, yeah, it's funny. So I know people who work for Trump simply because, you know, he's a New York real estate guy, right? So, like, you know, I know that world. I know, and they're smart people. He has some good people work for him. You know, what, I don't think they necessarily subscribe to his political views. I have no idea if they're going to go to the White House or if they're going to stay and work at the company or what. But, yeah, he does have some really good – I think he has some horrific personal business practices, like not paying people – but he has some smart people who work for him, and I suspect he'll hire intelligently. The real question is, what are his underlying views? I was just meeting with a company a few minutes ago that is a kind of a B2B enterprise software that connects grow facilities and dispensaries for legal sale of cannabis. And they were saying, like, what do you think Trump's policies are in cannabis? I'm like, I don't know. I don't think he knows. I think the trick is to, you know, figure out who he appoints as head of the DEA and go see him. Just say, like, here are our views, and see if you can, you know, get your point across. So anyway, going back to the story, you know, we were looking for ways to generate more money for schools without raising taxes. And all but 46 U.S. states have state-based lotteries. And the only thing they all have in common is they all stink. And the reason they all stink is because you've got government employees trying to run a consumer products business, and they don't know what they're doing. And so the two bad things happen. One is they're not nearly as profitable as they should be because they're not good at their jobs. But two, much sadder, is because they're not good at this, they pick off the lowest hanging fruit, which are poor people and old people. So U.S. lotteries are highly regressive because that's the only people they're capable of reaching through the sales process. And so, for example, in the U.K., Camelot runs the British lottery. It's a very sophisticated company. And they've been able to really broaden the player base to the people who have discretionary income, able to buy a ticket. So that's really how they funded the Olympics. So they said, okay, it's a good cause. Maybe I want something I don't want. That's not really why I'm doing it in the first place. So the idea is, why can't we bring that system to the U.S.? And so started looking at it for Illinois and said, I really like this idea. So I went to all the different banks on Wall Street and said, I want to build out a business within your bank to do this. And so I was lucky to get a lot of job offers. But my concern was that they all just want me to do their politics, not really build a banking business, which I had a vision of what I wanted to build. And there was one company that really, I felt, believed in my vision. And to their credit, you know, through to the last day, they were true to their word. They also took down the global economy, and they were called Lehman Brothers. And so, you know, I'm at Lehman. I'm trying to sell these lotteries. And, you know, the ship goes down. And, you know, this sort of series of lucky phone calls. Phone rings. Pull for Mike. What are you doing? I said, I think you know what I'm doing. He said, yeah, come see me. And the next thing I know, we're changing the rules around term limits to allow for a third term, and I'm running the campaign.
So, like, I mean, your time at Mike Bloomberg was very valuable to you in terms of learning how City Hall operated, you know. And I'm curious about the learnings you've made in the post Bloomberg era, you know. And also, like, I mean, yeah, I suppose in two regards. One regard, kind of, one of your clients is Uber in terms of like what you do at Uber. And also, what's your problem with Bill de Blasio? I mean, he strikes me as a big hunky fellow, you know. I mean, you seem to have a big problem. Did he kill your dog?
You know what? I'm going to claim that he did. He did not kill. Not yet. So I'll start with the Blasio and work backwards. Okay. So I would argue, and you guys may agree or disagree, that New York City is the best and most important city in the world. And I think that we should have a mayor who comes to work before 11:30 in the morning, who shows up on Fridays, who isn't under 7 separate federal criminal investigations for corruption, and who actually pays attention to the job and does good with it. And we don't have any of that in Bill de Blasio, and I just find it offensive. I just think that the cities are not inherently safe or unsafe. They're not inherently clean or dirty. They're not inherently well-run or poorly run. It's completely based on the people in charge, how smart they are, how hard they work, the quality of people they appoint. And de Blasio, by just being lazy and corrupt, has really taken New York City in the wrong direction.
Well, who's he in allegiance to? Who does he owe things to?
Labor unions, mainly. You know, a very, very kind of left-wing Bernie. His dream was that Sanders was going to win the primary and make him the VP. And he actually thought that that was plausible. I don't think Sanders thought of that ever. But that's de Blasio's worldview. And he just outsources all decision-making to unions and others. And I think there are some really good unions, but it shouldn't dictate government. It should be a stakeholder within government having conversations. But that's not how he sees it. And so, you know, I have nothing gained by de Blasio not being mayor. You know, people keep speculating I'm going to run for mayor, and my wife would literally kill me. I'm not going to run for mayor. But you know, I took a look at it, and everyone kind of bitches and moans about it, and we go to the same fancy places for breakfast that, you know, totally missed the presidential election, probably helped elect Trump by accident, and everyone complains about the guy, and no one does anything. I said, okay, Bradley, you understand New York City politics. You run a mayoral campaign here. You understand new ways of reaching and mobilizing voters through technology, through platforms like Uber and FanDuel and others. We can talk about that. You've got some money to put into this. You've got credibility with the press. So if you feel so strongly about it, do something about it. And so I launched an effort called New York City Deserves Better. It's a super PAC. I need to get rid of de Blasio. I need a candidate. So if anybody here would like to be mayor of New York City, come see me afterwards. So that's my issue with de Blasio. With Mike, what's interesting is I learned two things. I wouldn't say I learned how City Hall works because he was such an outlier, so atypical, that his City Hall didn't work like anyone else's City Hall. His City Hall worked like Bloomberg LP. An incredibly efficient, well-run, well-resourced, well-staffed operation that took completely pragmatic, non-political views to any problem and provided a logical solution and brought it through, which is almost as how government should always be run, almost never is run. And so it was a pleasure to work for Mike in his first term, to help elect him as mayor for the third term. So that's one. Two, you know, I own a bunch of different companies now, and, you know, our culture and management style is completely patterned after what I learned in working for Mike. And three, I think one of the reasons that I now spend so much of my time at this intersection of technology and politics is when Uber came to New York, so this was early 2011, Uber's second market, they were just raising their A round at the time, the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission slaps Uber with a cease and desist order, mainly because just didn't really understand what Uber is. And
I assume that's how the TLC operate as well. I mean, that's like,
yeah, and it wasn't, you know, I don't think it was malicious. I think they didn't know, and they said, hey, stop operating until we figure this out. So I'm sitting in a meeting with Walmart, it was a client of mine. My phone rings, and I excuse myself and take it. And the guy on the line says, hey, there's a guy with a small transportation startup. He's having some regulatory problems. Can you do me a favor and talk to him? So I become Uber's first consultant that day. I got really lucky when Travis calls me back and says, can't afford your fee, we should take some equity. And I'm like, yeah, what the fuck? So thank God, you know, that was during the A and some sense.
Okay.
And we were in a position, though, and this is where Mike is unique, is we were able to go back to the TLC and say, look, Uber is a technology company, not a limousine company. We were able to demonstrate why. And unlike pretty much every other transportation regulator in the country and the world that we've dealt with, rather than just taking the industry side, they said, oh, we like innovation, we like technology, this is interesting, go ahead, which was great. Not an experience we've had basically anywhere else ever, But it really helped me formulate a view as to how that intersection of technology and politics should at its best operate.
Are you finding as well, Bradley, that like you're getting approaches more and more from technology companies who realize they need that kind of political muscle, that political moxie, that political know-how?
Yeah, although I would say for a much more basic reason, which is, you know, we talk about tech startups, but what new company is created that is not technology-enabled in some way? By definition, and it's any business created in 2016 is going to be a tech-enabled business, and the vast majority of businesses, at least in the United States, or either directly or indirectly regulated by government. We once looked at the Fortune 200 and concluded that 92% of the listings on there had some sort of regulatory relationship in some way. And so if you are a new startup in transportation or energy or education or healthcare or gaming or any sector, you're going to have some sort of regulatory problem or opportunity you want to pursue. And, you know, we launched a business a little over a year ago that played on what we did with Uber, and still do with Uber, and said, okay, we're going to work with pre-IPO companies and regulated industries. We're going to solve these problems for you. We're going to do them all over the U.S., now all over the world, and we only work for equity. So we're building a venture fund, but solely based on that. I'm the LP for that business. And then on top of that, we did a first close for a fund last week, and I can't get into too many details, but we're in a position now to deploy capital in the portfolio companies we work with that we really like as well.
Okay, final couple of questions, and I really, really thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. I want to let you get back to your wife and enjoy your vacation in Lisbon. You
know, if I miss my flight, she's going to be pissed at you.
I know. Sure. Fuck it. I'll wrap it up really quickly. You mentioned earlier on a bunch of people that you kind of like take wisdom from over the years, people like Chuck, people like Mike, people like Rod even, all these mentions. What do you learn from them?
You know, what's interesting is what you learn is both what to do and what not to do, right? So with Mike, it's mainly what to do. With Pogoyev, it's like, don't steal, don't break the law. With Schumer, Chuck Schumer is a brilliant, hardworking man, and there are things about Chuck that I really try to emulate, like his work ethic. But there are also things where there's that joke, the most dangerous place in Washington is between Chuck Schumer and a TV camera, and there's this need for constant validation and attention. And I try to be mindful of not being like that. I say that as our PR firm is sitting right there, being paid to promote the hell out of me. So maybe I'm a hypocrite. But nonetheless, so, you know, there are things that you learn from all of them. And I think the real trick is a lot of people that you work for have a lot to offer. And the real skill set is not paying attention. It's paying attention to both what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And if you can draw those conclusions properly, you're really going to learn a lot.
Last question. You deflected earlier on. You were kind of saying a lot of people saying you should run for mayor or whatever, you know. Do you think it's possible? And you can laugh at this. Do you think it's possible for a gobshite like Andy Weider to make a comeback?
I think Andy's actually highly likely to end up in prison because some of his sexting was with minors, and he did that knowingly. So, no, and it's funny. So, in 2009, the guy that I was afraid was going to beat Mike was Anthony. Anthony's a tremendously gifted politician. And I felt like he had the political skills because you keep in mind, Mike was even though he's independent, we ran on the Republican line. If any of us were the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, we walk in with 45% of the vote no matter who we are. So if you're on the other side, you have to win 50.1 of the remaining 55%. It's a pretty heavy lift. And Anthony was a talented enough politician that, in my view, would pick up that other 6% and win. And so we ran this just vicious fucking campaign that just bullied him out of the race. And what's interesting is we didn't know about this stuff. Twitter wasn't even really invented then, but we knew he was into weird shit. And we let him know.
You knew at that stage.
So, you know, he worked for Schumer, and so I knew Anthony from the Schumer days, and a lot of Schumer people became Bloomberg people. So we all knew each other, and I said to them, look, I did it through the New York Times, I said, look, I'm going to spend $20 million investigating you, because keep in mind, it's my Bloomberg, I had an unlimited budget, I am going to destroy you. So if you don't beat us, I am going to absolutely wipe out your career, and he wisely decided to take a pass. But, you know, the crazy thing was, had we not done that, his original sexting scandal would have happened not on the backbench of Congress, which effectively is totally immaterial and irrelevant, but at Gracie Mansion. He would have made Bill de Blasio look like a good mayor. So I think we did a tremendous public service to the people of New York City by knocking him out of the race.
Brady Tusk, thanks a minute for joining us at Banter.
Great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Bradley for joining us at Banter, and thanks to Dara, Elner, Katrin, James, Kira and Richard at Web Summit, and local crew Josh, Caesar and Ricardo for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit, and check thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again.